Wissen. Handeln. Der Podcast zur engagierten Wissenschaft.
Welcome to the podcast on science and activism, run by the Junge Akademie, Germany's Young Academy. How can researchers best engage with society and influence policy? Are they perhaps even ought to be active beyond academic discourse? And what are the dangers of and problems with such advocacy? We tackle these questions in a series of conversations under the tagline Wissen Handeln, which roughly translates as Knowledge Action, a podcast on science and activism. This podcast is run by the working group Engagierte Wissenschaft of the Junge Akademie, which addresses the motivation and experience of politically or socially active researchers. My name is David Labonte. I'm a member of the Junge Akademie based at Imperial College in London, where I work on biomechanics.
And I am Gisela Kopp, based at the University of Konstanz in Thalheim, Germany. I am a biologist with a focus on behavioral and evolutionary biology and genomics, and also a member of the Junge Akademie. Today, we are very delighted to speak with Dr. Elisabeth Bick, a microbiologist by training and a science integrity consultant by profession. Elisabeth, welcome, and thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
I'm so happy to be here.
Elisabeth, you have left the traditional academic career track to focus full time on the identification of scientific misconduct and fraud, especially through what you call image forensics, the screening of images in peer-reviewed publications for evidence of image manipulation. Your work has resulted in hundreds of retractions and corrections. Many of these have not attracted much public attention, but some have considerably so. You have uncovered evidence for paper factories, that is, companies which invent papers on demand. More recently, you have openly and prominently raised questions about the academic rigor and integrity of high-profile work on allegedly effective COVID treatments. Your work has not been received positively by all. Your social media account is regularly the target of hate speech and slander, and a criminal complaint has been filed against you. And your scientific expertise and integrity has been questioned repeatedly. Evidently, your work and your decision to share it publicly under your real name has resulted in substantial personal costs, but you stand strong. Recently, you received the John Mendox Prize 2021. Congratulations from us on this achievement.
Thank you so much.
And clearly, you're an active and outspoken scientist and thus wonderfully suited to provide some insights in the motivation and realities of life as an activist researcher. Elisabeth, the story of how you initially got interested in problems surrounding academic integrity is well established in the media. You discovered that parts of your work were used by others without appropriate citation. Can you tell us a little bit more about the point in time when you decided to first invest a significant fraction of your free time into image forensics?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, like you said, I was investigating papers that had plagiarized other people's text. And just by a coincidence, I was flipping through a PhD thesis that had plagiarized text. And I saw a couple of images that looked familiar. And there was one particular image, a photo of what we call a Western blot. So it's a blot where proteins are detected through antibodies. And that blot had a little smudge that I recognized, a particular irregularity. And I thought, I've seen this before, and I flipped back through the pages and I found it in another chapter. And it was the same photo, but it was upside down. It had been rotated. And I thought, that's weird. How can that be? Is it the same experiment? And I looked at the labels and it was actually a different experiment. So it was the same photo being used twice to represent two different experiments. And because it was also upside down, it seemed to have been done intentionally. And in combination with the fact that this paper also, this thesis also had plagiarism, I thought, well, this is a person who is maybe not very honest about their research. And the paper with the duplicated blot also had been published. There were two papers published and there were additional problems. So I got angry and I thought maybe this happens more in published papers. If this happens in one paper, maybe if I go online, I can find more examples. So that evening was sort of a determining moment where I went online. I looked for other examples of duplicated images, and I found several that evening. I think if that had not happened, my life would have been very differently.
And when or why did you then at some point decide to take on this full time without a secure payment also?
That initial discovery was in 2014. And I kept on doing this as a hobby. So a weird hobby, of course, but I just flipped through thousands and thousands of papers. And I wrote with two others, I wrote a paper about it. And that was in 2016. And I kept on doing it. I just screened more and more images. And around 2019, I was working at a startup. And the job didn't really fit me very well, but I was actually noticing that every evening when I came home, I was looking forward to work on image duplication detection. And I thought that was much more gratifying for me than my actual work. And yeah, so I decided I should just quit my job, do this as a consultant and do it for a year. First, see if it's financially sustainable, work as a consultant on the side and see if that works. And it turned out, yes, I can make a living by doing consulting work, specializing in image forensic, but also free up a lot of my time to do this work almost full time.
It's interesting that you say you found it gratifying to do this. And in a couple of your interviews, you've stated that you like what you do quite a lot.
Yes.
I mean, everyone wants to do a job that they like, I guess, right?
Of course.
But my understanding is that the reality of what you do also is often just scroll through many papers per day and look at many, many images. So many people would probably think that relatively draining as a task. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more of what you actually enjoy about this and what motivates you to keep going and open paper after paper, scroll through, be very systematic and methodological, I guess. Maybe you can say a little bit about the joy of that work.
I guess I'm a person who enjoys doing repetitive work as long as I feel there's value in it. And so for me, the value of finding these things is to post them online and to write to the editors and to basically flag these papers for problems. Because it's not just finding these papers. I want to tell the readers that there might be a potential problem with these papers. So I post all of these on pubpeer.com, which is a website where you can talk about papers and potential problems or concerns. And then if people have a plugin that works with Papier, they can see that a particular paper has been flagged. And so for me, there's joy in finding these things, sort of like searching for an Easter egg and, you know, looking in your garden and, oh, I found an egg. For me, that's the same feeling. There's some fun in that. But I also realized that these potential problems could lead to other people trying to replicate these results and you know, if they're falsified. I want to tell that to the reader. So I post these things on Papier. And for me, that feels like a little bit of closure. Now I've flagged these papers. Other people can see that there's a problem with it. And now I'll move on and see if I can find more.
You're not the only person to post papers on Papier or flag them, but you are one of the very few, if not the only one, who does regularly do so under her public name, right? So you
that's
use
right.
your real
that's
name
right.
and not an acronym. And that is, I don't think anyone can doubt that that's a brave decision to take because it has certainly resulted in quite a lot of backlash. Can
yes.
you say a little bit about why you did that and whether you think others should do the same? Would that help? Yeah. So maybe a bit of the motivation for using your real name would be quite helpful.
Right. Yeah. So when I started this work, there was there were already other people doing this, but this was a little bit Papier wasn't that big or I hadn't heard about it yet. And so there were other people finding problems in papers and writing to editors. And some of these did that under a pseudonym. And I immediately realized that a lot of editors tend to ignore it. When you get an anonymous letter with a problem, it's easy to ignore it. But I thought if I write under my full name, back then I worked at Stanford, so I felt that gives a little bit of authority. If I, you know, say that I'm a researcher at Stanford, people can see I really exist. This is my full name. It gives a little bit more substance to my concerns. And so I immediately did that under my full name. When I discovered Papier, I did post some of these anonymously, some under my full name, and I gradually skipped the anonymous accounts, and I now post almost always under my full name.
How do you actually choose the papers you investigate? Are you particularly interested in articles with a clear potential for some impact, so very like shiny articles or where you expect some societal impact? And if not, why not? Do you just like go through the literature like randomly or like specific fields in particular?
Yeah, I a little bit of all of them. So I do get a lot of tips. People send me per email or through all kinds of channels, LinkedIn, Twitter. They will send me papers or names of researchers that they feel should be checked. And so I might get an email saying, oh, this particular paper, I think there might be a problem in figure three. Can you check that? And so I will. And in some cases, I don't see a problem. And there might be, you know, people might sometimes have intentions of revenge. And so they just don't like a particular other researcher and they send me these tips. And I, yeah, if I don't find a problem and they send me a couple more papers that don't have a problem, I'll tell them like I don't think you really are sending me anything valuable. But in most of the cases, yes, there is a problem and I agree with it and I will post these things on Papier. And then from every paper that I find a problem with, it could lead to other papers. So I will scan other papers by the same researcher, the same first researcher, or same first author, same last author. And sometimes it's sort of like detective work, right? You follow different leads and you find something and a lot of other leads don't lead to anything. And then suddenly you feel, I think it's this particular name, this particular author that is indeed involved in the image manipulation. And so every paper that I get a tip of will or might lead to 100 more papers of me being screened. So I'm never out of work.
And would you consider this work to be like purely scientific, or is there also a political aspect to it?
I don't think there's a political aspect to it. Although in with COVID, of course, a lot of science became political. And so in the last year, we've seen that, of course, we were in a pandemic and there was a new virus and people were dying and everybody was, sort of in a panic mode. Everybody wanted to, all researchers wanted to know how this virus was transmitted, what type of treatments would work. And yeah, so at some point, hydroxychloroquine was suggested as a treatment option. And President Trump in the US tweeted about it. And that made it immediately political because I wrote a critical review about hydroxychloroquine. And so that a lot of people said that then that made me a liberal. And only if you were a Republican, you would support hydroxychloroquine. But science is not political. Like for me, science is about finding the truth and what you think about politicians, about particular decisions that should not have to do anything with science. And yet it became highly polarized because I wrote a critical review. I was suddenly against hydroxychloroquine, which I wasn't. Like, if that would have worked, that would have been great. Turned out it didn't. But if it had worked, that was fantastic. I was just critical about a particular paper. And so I don't think science should be political. But unfortunately, in the past year, we've seen that science became political and highly polarizing.
And this particular case is interesting, right? Because you probably weren't aware at the time when you wrote that critical review that it might attract so much attention and also so much backlash. So I think this is a nice example of where your decision to publish under your name has exposed you to quite an extreme reaction, right? So your social media account, you often share tweets or messages that you send, and they're very unpleasant, to say the least, right? So you have faced harassment, slander, personal threats, legal threats, all as a consequence of your decision to do this under your name. Was there ever a point where you thought, maybe I should go full anonymous or I should no longer use my name?
No, there were definitely points where I thought maybe I should not be on Twitter for a while, or maybe I should just shut up for a year and then come back. But those were very brief moments. I always felt I should be doing this because there should be a critical voice. There should be, if a paper turns out to have serious concerns, somebody should raise that. And it's like the emperor's new clothes. Somebody should point out to the emperor and say he has no clothes on. And maybe that should be me. Maybe that's my task in life for now, to be that person. And I'm not alone. There's many others who are critical and face the same problems, unfortunately. But as long as I feel that I have something critical to say, and I feel I have all the right to say that, I will keep on doing this.
What is also interesting in your social media feed is then when you say you publish a new image and say, can someone find a problem in this? Then often there's a series of tweets that thank you for your service to the academic community. And then there's a series of tweets that accuses you of doing something terrible. So there's this, there seems to be these two sides. Luckily, I mean, my impression is they're not of the equal size, but maybe one side is more vocal than its size would suggest. I'd be quite interested in how much the support that you've been getting from the academic community, for example, the open letter that was signed or the Citizen for Science initiative, helped you to stay focused, motivated, and reinforce your idea that you're doing something worthwhile, that is helpful and meaningful?
Yes, that support that I have received, that was after I received a legal threat by the person who wrote the hydroxychloroquine paper. That support was crucial in my decision to keep on doing this and to actually know that I was right. So having people support you, total strangers who might just follow me on Twitter or might not even do that, have those people sign a petition for me to show their support, that has meant a lot. And that has meant the world. It has just meant that, yes, I'm not alone. It seems sometimes when you are on Twitter and you get these negative results, even if you get 10 positive results and one really bad tweet calling me a failed scientist or comparing me to Nazis or like, you know, death threats, that one tweet actually weighs somehow psychologically, that weighs heavier than 10 positive tweets. It's not a one-on-one ratio, but even if it's just one negative tweet, it can weigh much heavier. And so having those petitions signed, set up for me and showing support for me, yeah, that has shown so much support that I kept on doing what I have been doing. And it was just fantastic that people went through the trouble of setting that up for me.
Maybe in a transition sort of from talking about your personal perspective and then people who support you to institutions that are involved in all of this malarkey, do you sometimes feel like the academic community as large could have done more to support your activities or to be more outspoken about your support? Or is it individuals that are largely outspoken? Or do you think some institutions like universities or publishers could also come out in public support of the work of scientific integrity consultants? Not necessarily only you, also others, right, I guess?
Yeah, there's many others doing the work that I'm doing. I might be one of the more visible persons because I do this under my full name. As of now, it's mainly individuals setting up petitions, organizing, you know, like nominating me for the MedX Prize. That all depends on individuals doing something. The support from the publishers community and institutional community, like universities, has so far been a little bit less, let's put it that way. Some publishers have written some positive things about me, but I haven't seen a lot of actions yet. So one thing that disappoints me a lot is that scientific publishers have not really done much for science integrity. They have nice words and they have lots of guidelines and things that come out, but I haven't seen a lot of actual response. So I have a particular set of papers, 800 papers that I reported in 2014 and 15. I've been following that paper set over 5 or 6 years. So after waiting for 6 years, after reporting these papers to the publishers, only 40% of these have been retracted or corrected. And 60% of the papers, the majority of the papers, have not been acted upon. So it's really bad that publishers don't respond to these cases. And then waiting for 6 years seems a very long time in science world, right? We sometimes need these papers to be addressed very quickly.
Then also let's talk about the researchers who submit these papers with manipulated data or manipulated figures. What do you think is the motivation behind that?
Well, all scientists feel the pressure to publish. And scientific publications are the way that scientists are measured, are the way that their productivity is measured. So all scientists feel this pressure to publish. We do research, and the research itself is not really our productivity, at least to the outside world. It's a paper that is being published. This is the way that scientists communicate with each other. And so if we put too much pressure on papers to be published per time unit, so if you tell a graduate student you can only graduate if you have 4 papers published, then that leads people to cheat. If you ask people to do impossible things, they will cheat. And one region where we see this very strongly is that in China, there's this requirement for medical doctors to publish a paper in order for them to get a position or a promotion at a clinical hospital. So these are clinical doctors. They're not, they're not necessarily interested in research, but they have to publish a research paper in order to get a position and a good salary and, to get further on in their career. And so these people are not, they don't have time to do research. They work in a hospital. They don't have research facilities, but they need this paper. So this is a hurdle they need to take. And so this has led to people buying authorships on papers that are completely fabricated. So there's this whole new industry that that started there where papers are completely made up and are sold to authors who need them. So this is an example where people are not necessarily, worse or better in a particular country. But if a country has a particular requirement that is impossible to take, then people will cheat.
Do you think then that the incidence rate of fraud has increased over the last maybe 1 to 2 decades with the competitiveness becoming so much stronger or is perceived as stronger?
I'm not sure. I feel the amount of papers that we as a scientific community produce has gone up a lot. And papers are also much more complicated. If you look at the papers that I published to get my PhD, they're now very simple. And the papers that, generations older than me published, they're even more simpler. So papers have become much more complex, much more harder to oversee. If a paper only has one table or one graph, you can easily, maybe more easily spot misconduct. If a paper has hundreds or millions of sequence reads or tables, it's just very hard and complex to really spot misconduct there. So I'm not sure if it has gone up, but the amount of papers that we publish as a scientific community has gone up. So the absolute numbers of papers with frauds has gone up, but that's maybe just because we publish more. And it's hard to really know data on that.
You already said that you think that the strong focus on metrics and increased competition also for positions has been a factor contributing to this. What do you think that individual academics could do to disincentivize fraud?
Oh, difficult question, because, as one person, you can be against fraud. But when push comes to shove, when you are in a situation that you feel the only way out is to do fraud, then you'll do that. There have been sad stories that I'm aware of where people work in labs with a bully as a professor, and they need their PhD, they need their paper, they need to go out of that lab. And some professors threaten their postdocs or their graduate students by firing them. And if you're on a visa, and then you might actually have to leave the country. At least in the United States, you have to leave the country within 5 days if you are fired and you are on a visa. So people are in impossible situations, and they have all the best intentions of the world. But if you are in a situation like that, and academia is a very hierarchical structure, there's enormous power in the professor. And as a graduate student, you have very little power. So in a situation like that, you are almost forced. You might be feeling that the only way out is to do misconduct, and you're forced to do that. And individuals are sometimes of really good intentions, but we need to deal with big publishers and big institutions. And so one individual is not enough to change the world. We need to have people change the way we think about science integrity on a much larger scale, because I've met many people who work at publishers or institutions who have very good intentions. But then they want to change the world, and the people above them say, no, we cannot do that. So we need the individuals to keep on working on this before we can start to see real changes on the institutional level and the scientific publisher level.
It's interesting that we're now going back to institution and publishers. We talked about the individuals, but they're not the only stakeholders in this situation, right? Scientific fraud is very serious. It hampers scientific progress. It wastes money. It wastes time. It reduces public confidence in the integrity of science. So it should really concern scientists, the institutions they represent, the publishers who publish the work, the funding agencies who fund the work, and the taxpayer who pays for it. So there's a lot of stakeholders in this. And if you think of academic institutions, there have been a couple of high-profile cases where universities, which still host the vast majority of research that is published, have launched investigations into academic misconduct. And often these investigations are slow, they take a lot of time, they have to be very thorough, they have to be fair. Do you think that the procedures that currently exist at these institutions to deal with misconduct are fit for purpose?
No, most of the times there's too many conflicts of interest. So if you have a professor who brings in a lot of grant money, for example, and they are implicated in misconduct, they get an allegation and there are papers with problems and there's real evidence. Even in those cases, in most of the cases, the institution will decide that there were some errors made, but it wasn't real misconduct. And then maybe some graduate student gets fired and the researchers themselves who oversaw the lab are still in place. And we've also seen this with sexual harassment and misconduct, where it's, of course, a very different level. I don't want to compare it to academic misconduct, but we've seen similar cases where the same people can keep on doing what they're doing because they are powerful and they're valuable for university. These people who are, these professors bring in money. So for them, they're the rainmakers of the university and they're almost untouchable. And if you have a new university investigating these cases, there's also too many direct lines of people knowing each other. So there might be an allegation, there might be a committee, some people are investigating this professor's work or this graduate student's work, but very often people in the university know each other. They've been in committees together. They went to a pub together and drank a beer. So it's hard to then criticize your coworker and to investigate their work for misconduct. So I feel that in a lot of these cases, universities are not really fit to investigate these cases. And we almost need to go to a country-wide or maybe continent-wide sort of institution that is more independent, where people can investigate these cases with a more objective vision.
So do you think that would be basically the way forward, is to try and establish truly independent commissions that investigate these cases regularly, I guess, and almost professional standing commissions? Or
yes, I feel that's the only way forward. I have seen very few cases where a university investigates what appears from the outside, at least, to be a clear case of misconduct, and came to the conclusion that this researcher was indeed wrong. I've almost only seen cases where the big boss got a very little reprimand. Some younger folks are thrown under the bus, but this person can keep on going doing research and keeps on making the same mistakes. And so I feel that we need to not have we. Universities should not be investigating these cases, and there should be a more independent organization doing that. Yes.
I mean, I guess lots of the investigations conducted by universities would be after the situation has already gone downhill, if you will, because fraudulent research has been published. I think there's also an interesting question as to what publishers are ought to do to reduce the number of manuscripts that are published with relatively clear cases of fraud.
Right.
I think Plus One, for example, I think in response to your original study, has actually established a small team of in-house professional integrity consultants that are working on trying to identify or investigate cases of fraud that you have raised. Mm-hmm. Do you anticipate moving forward that more and more publishers will maybe even have professional teams that they employ to do that sort of work?
Yeah, I feel that change is slowly coming. It's slowly, with the emphasis on slowly. Because it's much better for everybody involved to catch these cases before they're being accepted and published. If we can catch these cases at the manuscript level before they get accepted, or maybe at the point where they're accepted and not yet published, that is much better for everyone. It's better for the reader because they don't see these cases. They're just caught before they are being published. But it's also better for the people doing the misconduct because they will get a clear message saying, hey, this paper has a big problem and we're not going to accept it. So it should work as a deterrent. And yes, I feel this should be done by the publishers. I'm doing this work mostly unpaid, and this work should be done by the publishers. We pay them a lot of money to get our papers published or to read them. And some part of that money should go to quality control. We should, if you buy a product, you want that to be of a good quality. And so it seems very reasonable to ask the publishers to not just depend on peer review, which is done by unpaid volunteers mostly, but to also screen a paper with a different viewpoint, that of, is this paper real? Is this paper misconduct? Is this paper fabricated? Looking at that way is very different than a peer review, because peer reviewers are not trained to look at papers like that. But if you look at it from that point of view, then you might catch a lot of misconduct before it gets published.
I guess in some ways, one could say that the incentive that publishers have currently to invest resources in this is relatively little, because if there's a paper published with fraud, they don't seem to really face any consequences, right? The consequences are the scientific community, the consequences are on the authors that published fraudulent work. But the publishers, by and large, can just go on and publish manuscripts one after another. Do you think there would be an argument to be made that publishers should be held responsible to some extent if they publish fraudulent work or obviously fraudulent work?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure if they should be held responsible, but we should definitely ask them to act upon these papers, to correct them, to retract them, and to just not publish them in the first place. And it seems reasonable. If I buy a car and the wheel falls off, I should be able to go back to the car dealer and get a new car, or at least a new wheel. You know, like it seems reasonable if you buy an expensive product to demand some quality control. But there is this huge power that scientific publishers have, and they seem to care more and more about making money than about publishing good research. And I feel the cost of publishing has only gone up. Well, the actual cost of publishing has in reality only gone down, because everything is now online. It's, you know, we peer review the papers for free and we even write them for free. Where does this $4,000 that I pay for to get a paper published, where does that go to? Part of that should be going to quality control, and publishers make lots of money. They have like huge profits, and they don't seem to care about this. And I'm not sure how to change this as an individual, but as a scientific community, we do have the power to maybe not send our papers anymore to these particular publishers, and to organize ourselves and to maybe boycott particular publishers that don't seem to care about quality control. So we do have powers as individuals, but we need to organize that in some way.
I mean, I think your car analogy is interesting though, right? Because you say, oh, if I buy an expensive car and there's a faulty product, then I have the right to give it back and demand some form of quality control and check. But I think also you would hold the seller of the car responsible for selling you that car with a faulty product in the first place, right? So where publishers don't investigate or invest a reasonable amount of resources into making sure that the work that they publish is of high integrity standards, maybe there is an argument to be made that they should be held responsible as well to hold them accountable.
Yeah, because it is very expensive nowadays to publish an open access paper. It's like $3,000-$5,000, depending on where you send it and where does that money go to. It's very, it's not very transparent where these publishers spent all that money on. It's just, you know, I can see some work being done on a paper. It's, you know, it's typeset and it's published online, but it's not published anymore in paper, or at least the paper cost of printing have gone down a lot because all these things are sold online. Yeah, we should hold them accountable for the quality of the products that they sell. Absolutely.
With this much more publishing going open access, some of the biggest journals are now completely open access. Do you think that the emergence of such journals and in general this increasing open access publishing has created an incentive for the journals to publish substandard work, or is it maybe also the other way around?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, because it's a good thing to have open access publishing. I know that myself. I am not affiliated with an institution, and so I don't have access to paywall papers. So I love papers being open access, and it's very good for traditionally underprivileged privileged communities where people have not always had access to science papers. Like in certain countries, there's a huge advantage being made for those people to be able to read those papers as well. So I'm very much in favor of open access publishing, but it also has led to some publishers making misuse of that model, because you can ask a big amount of money up front. The publisher then already have that money. Instead of depending on selling papers, you already, as a publisher, have had the money up front. And so that sort of makes people maybe in the scientific publishing world less concerned about the quality, because they have their money already, so why should they care? And we've also seen this in particular with predatory publishers, where there has been this whole new community of so-called scientific publishers that don't seem to care about quality at all, that will just accept whatever is sent their way, and sort of serving a community who wants to publish and making lots of profit without doing any quality control. And it's very hard to distinguish, even for scientists, to distinguish between predatory publishers and real legit publishers. And sometimes that line is very thin, and yeah, it's just hard to know which papers are real and which are not real.
If you had to provide an attempt at a definition, though, of a predatory publisher, what is it that you would say?
It's very hard to give that definition, because there's a couple of what one would call legit publishers that are being indexed in PubMed, which is the index of biological and medical papers. So these journals are included in PubMed, and that gives them sort of a shiny sense of legitness. And those papers sometimes appear to be very predatory. So there's a lot of gray value in between. There are lists of journals that are legit in terms of open access, that they have to belong to COPE members, the Commission of Publication Ethics, or there's a list of open access publishers that are legit. But yeah, there's a lot of fake lists as well. So it's actually very hard to draw that distinction. In general, I usually say if it's PubMed index, it's probably okay. But yeah, that's not always the case. So it's hard to draw a straight line there.
Maybe as a last point on this subject of the institution, the individuals, the publishers, you have mentioned peer review before, and you said that normally a peer reviewer might not be trained to recognize cases of fraud, at least in images in particular, which takes quite a lot of practice, for all I can say anyway. Now, if I recall correctly, in one of your papers, you did find very weak evidence that papers in high-ranking journals tend to have less incidence of fraud. Is that hope for the peer review process, or is that an artifact and not really strong enough to draw conclusions? Or what would you say that? How would you interpret that result?
Right. Yeah. So that is correct. I looked at a set of 40 different journals, and it seemed that journals with high impact factors, such as Science and Nature, had fewer image problems than low impact journals. Wasn't a complete exact correlation, but there seemed to be some correlation there. And I think that's because of several reasons. So first of all, people who submit papers to high impact journals like Science and Nature tend to be experienced researchers. They know what their audience wants. They have large research groups. They make the big discoveries. And so they sometimes also their names of their institutions will already give some sense of authority. And so those are people who are very experienced, and they might still do fraud. That's hard to know, but they might also be more experienced in fraud, or they might just have better ways of hiding it. So I'm only finding the visible fraud, the dumb fraudsters. And I think these people, if they do fraud, it's probably more advanced and harder to catch. So that might be one reason. And of course, there's also more experienced peer reviewers. So the people who tend to peer review for the big name journals, the Science and the Nature, are usually also experienced researchers themselves. And so they might catch more of these things. And there's also just more eyes on them. There's more experienced staff at these journals that might catch these problems before they're being published. So it's a combination of reasons, but it doesn't necessarily mean there's less fraud in those papers. It just means it's less visible and harder to catch.
A common result from a forensic report that is a published correction Maybe you already said that often the you don't think that the answer of the publishers, for example, is what you would like it to be. And this often also leaves the main work unaffected. So they often say, oh, we made this mistake, or maybe this figure is wrong, but the main result is unaffected. Do you think this is appropriate? Is one problematic figure to question the integrity of the entire paper or even the responsible scientists and their previous work valid? Do you think?
Yeah, I usually don't agree with that. So first of all, I focus on image problems. So an image usually in a paper, it's a figure. It's part of a figure, and it might be a small part of the figure. But if there's a problem in the figure, that is the data. A figure is not just a little illustration. It's not a children's book with a fluffy little picture of the topic of the book. It's actual data. You show the photo in order to support your hypothesis or your findings. And so I feel that in every figure, if there's an error or discovered or even fraud, that does affect the conclusions. Maybe not the conclusion of the paper itself, but the conclusion I have about the validity of the data, the validity of the paper. So, but there's also a gradation of types of errors that one might find in images. So sometimes an image might have been used just by accident. Somebody didn't label the samples very well. And the researcher immediately, when they're pointed out of their mistake, they will say, oh, yes, you're right. Here's the original figure. We should have done this. There's something went wrong. And sorry. And that is acceptable. But when there's one particular photo that has photoshopped elements in it, for example, a photo where you see the same cell 10 times in the same photo, that seems to not have happened by accident. And in those cases, I feel the paper should be retracted. Even if it's only one figure, that for me as a reader would completely destroy the confidence I have in all the other data and just the way that the authors mentored each other. I would not trust that anything from that paper. So I feel that paper should be retracted. But of course, there's a lot of gray values, like there can be, is it an error? Was it done intentionally? It's hard for me by just looking at images to know that. There might be some clear cases and there might be some harder to evaluate types of findings.
Elisabeth, maybe we can start thinking a bit about where we think this should all be going. So how do we address this problem moving forward as an academic community? And I guess we talked about this briefly before. You've been criticized by some, and often those were exactly those people that you flagged papers of, and that maybe it's not very surprising that some of these people lash out or feel attacked.
Of course, yeah. I can totally understand that, yes.
but maybe more surprisingly, there were also people that you could say are on the same side, as it were, that have said that flagging these papers publicly may hamper the process of misconduct investigations because people might have time to destroy evidence or they're warned, etc. And I think you've already said a little bit about the motivation why you do it publicly, because you felt that it wasn't necessarily taken seriously or appropriately seriously when it wasn't. But do you think moving forward that is the right way to go, or do you take the argument that that also can be detrimental to the overall process of dealing with frauds to do it publicly?
Yeah, I feel that I try to play it in the normal way, what a lot of people would consider the professional way. So I've tried to just raise these things by sending a letter to the editor, then having the editor in the institution start an investigation. But I've also been frustrated with how slow that process goes. So if I do it that way, and it takes even a year before the institution starts a real investigation, then the researcher will have had ample time to destroy all the evidence. So I now feel it's much more important to warn the readers and to do, that's why I post these things publicly. And it's a fast way for me to communicate there's a problem. Yes, that might lead to researchers destroying evidence, but they would have probably also had that opportunity if I had just flagged these papers by sending an email to the editor. And in many cases, there is no original evidence, right? If a person photoshopped a photo, like there is no raw data. There's that photo has never existed. And so I feel, yes, that's a valid point. But for me, the real value is in warning the reader, in a very fast way. For me, the judgment of people doing that is less important than the value of me posting that sooner for the reader, so that the reader can know that there's a real problem with the paper and might not base their research based on this one figure or this one paper. That's for me where the real value is, warning them quickly.
This scientific integrity is a fundamental element of being an academic, but students usually only encounter it when they hear some stories maybe about plagiarism. Do you think these principles of scientific integrity should be made a stronger part of the academic education in general?
Yeah, I agree. I just did a Twitter thread on that, asking people if they had scientific integrity training when they were early career. And I'm definitely not early career. I've never had any training myself. And so I'm sort of doing this even though I've never had any professional training on what I can and cannot do. For me, it felt sometimes natural to do this, but I've also struggled with some questions on, for example, throwing out an outlier. You know, can you do that or not? You've always learned how not to do that, but we also make exceptions to that. We always have these experiments that didn't quite look very nice, and we redo them. Is that tossing out an outlier? I've struggled with these questions. And yeah, so I feel there should be good training, and not just a 1 hour training of like, thou shall not plagiarize, but like having very realistic examples and discussions. And in many of these cases, there is no right or wrong. It's just you need to talk about the ethics of certain decisions. And sometimes you need to make these decisions with others, and you cannot really give more than just guidelines for young students. But I do feel it should be part of their training. As people are starting their research, they should have some training in that. But I also want to point out it should not just be training young researchers. It should also be training the mentors, the professors, maybe on a yearly basis, because in many cases, misconduct happens in labs where the senior researcher is actually the person who has created this atmosphere in a lab that leads to misconduct. I don't feel it's always the bad graduate student. It's sometimes, and maybe very often, it is the bad professor and who does not do misconduct maybe themselves, but creates this atmosphere in which misconduct happens. So there should not only be education of young people, but also monitoring or education of the more senior researchers, for sure.
This was, of course, also mean a lot of resources going into this training. Do you think this should be like a core thing that the universities have to provide, or who would be the institution that needs to tackle this?
Yeah, this should be a class that the university should give to young researchers and maybe to all researchers. Most institutions already give yearly classes, like on, I don't know, I've done many of bloodborne pathogen training, and you have to take that yearly, and sort of becomes maybe a joke, but in reality, these trainings have value and they sometimes can be better, but there is value in continuously training and reminding people, or at least making them aware where they can find researchers. So training like that has value, but it only has value if there's real life examples, if it's not just a dry, high level, reading about bad or wrong or good decisions, but to give people real examples of what they could have dealt with. I felt that those classes were always the best, where you have a little scenario of a person in doubt and like, what is the right decision and what is the wrong decision? I felt I've learned most of that. So that should be part of the curriculum. But also part of it should be in tackling these types of problems. I've seen many universities where they have wonderful trainings and lots of PDFs online, but I could not find the person I should contact to write my email with a concern to. Like it's not enough to just provide training. There should also be people who actively deal with these types of problems and tackle them and resolve them. A person to talk to. We don't want just resources. We need a person sometimes to talk to and address our concerns to. And in that respect, a lot of research institutions are still failing and they don't have that set up.
For you personally, could you say you had a specific mentor or person that kind of you went to for guidance on your like very special way?
That's a tough question. I've had great mentors. I'm not quite sure if I had a lot of training or mentoring for the types of problems we deal with, like that border on ethical decisions. But I've always felt I had a lot of good co-workers I could talk to, where you just, you have a coffee break and you ask another person for guidance. And I've always had the luck to work in laboratories with nice other people, and I could just talk about these things. I never felt that I was forced to do anything. So in that respect, I've been very lucky and I've had good mentors. But I've never really had to deal with that type of pressure that had forced me to make decisions about doing misconduct. I felt as long as I kept track of everything in my notebook, that's also what I sort of generally learned, I was able to justify my decisions. So I've had, in general, I've had good mentors in terms of respect, in terms of allowing me to fail, that some of my experiments didn't work. That was always fine. I have had a very nice professors who totally understood that happens in the lab and would never force me to do misconduct.
We are now approaching the end of this very interesting conversation. Is there something that we have not touched on so far where you think this is really crucial to address when we talk about your activism?
Well, I want to acknowledge a lot of the other people who do this work. So I don't do this work by myself. I'm visible because I do this work under my full name, but there's many, many others doing this work more in the shadows. And I do want to give them a little, spotlight, even though these people work under pseudonyms and they don't want to step in the front light. But I do want to highlight that other people are doing this work, unpaid, unrewarded. And I don't want to just take all the credit for the work they do. So I tend to get credit for the paper mill work, but there's other people doing who have actually done the most work on that. So I want to acknowledge Hoya, Morty, Tiger, Cheshire. There's lots of people doing this under pseudonyms, and they deserve the credit as well. And so thank you for doing all your work. And I hope they one day get that recognition as well.
Yeah, great. Elizabeth, Dr. Bick, thank you very much for taking the time. This has been a great, insightful discussion with, I think, lots of fodder for thought for everyone in the academic community interested in the issue of integrity, which should really be everyone. And it's very good to hear that there are many people like yourself out there who put in the hard hours and get the sometimes detrimental response for their work. And we thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on. I enjoyed being here, and thank you for asking really, really nice questions. Great, great work. Yeah.